From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We want people to understand that what happened to Amadou Diallo in that vestibule is going to take more than a paint job and a new door to erase it from the minds of the people in New York.
Nearly 1,000 people marked the second anniversary of the Amadou Diallo killing by four white police officers and protest the Justice Department's decision not to bring civil rights charges against them. We'll also hear an excerpt of a James Baldwin speech nearly 40 years ago on the killing of four little girls in the Birmingham church. And finally, Amnesty International sues the CIA to expose U.S. links to Colombia's death squads. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A top Russian security official sternly warned the new Bush administration yesterday that a planned U.S. national missile defense system would trigger a new arms race that would eventually extend into space. Sergei Ivanov, secretary of President Vladimir Putin's powerful Security Council, told an international conference in Munich of defense ministers and experts that the system would, by definition, abolish the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. He continued, quote, and the destruction of the AVM treaty, we are quite confident, will result in the annihilation of the whole structure of strategic stability and create prerequisites for a new arms race, including one in space. The importance of the treaty, quote, has not faded. By contrast, Bush's new defense secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, called it ancient history. Senator Joseph Lieberman supported Rumsfeld. And in other news in Russia, Russian security forces said yesterday that without paying so much as one kopeck in ransom or taking a single casualty, they freed the Queens-born aid worker who was kidnapped 3 weeks ago while providing medical assistance to the citizens of war-torn Republic of Chechnya. Yet officials offered few details for how Kenneth Gluck of Medecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, turned up at a Russian base Saturday night, freed from the masked gunmen who pulled him from a car, then vanished without ever publicly taking responsibility for the act or demanding a ransom. Nevertheless, with many questions remaining unanswered, the focus last night was on Gluck, who was alive, free, and eager to get home. The New York Times is reporting that the Bush administration has already managed to shift the focus of the European security debate. Despite deep-seated hopes that the missile defense issue would just go away, European officials now seem to accept grudgingly the fact that the new American team is determined to move ahead. The new mood was evident at the two-day conference in Munich, while ranking European officials failed to embrace Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's offer to help the European allies deploy their own defenses. There were no fiery dissents either. The Democratic National Committee elected Terry McAuliffe as its new chair this weekend, and he vowed to take on President Bush as fiercely as Republicans went after Bill Clinton. McAuliffe, a 43-year-old financial executive who is the most prolific fundraiser in party history, had the backing of Clinton and other party leaders, and his election was a foregone conclusion. McAuliffe calls himself a centrist who's more consumed with running the party and winning elections than pushing an ideological agenda. He says his best assets are that he's tireless and that people like him. McAuliffe's lone rival, former Mayor Maynard Jackson of Atlanta, had persisted in his campaign, questioning whether McAuliffe was a glorified fundraiser as well as his commitment to Southern Democrats. But Jackson, the first black mayor of Atlanta, withdrew after negotiations that went on until about 4 a.m. on Saturday. He said, "I'm more interested in fighting Republicans than having us fight each other." In return for endorsing McAuliffe, Jackson was named the party's national development chair, a post that will also give him responsibility to run a voting rights institute that the party plans to establish. This news from Jerusalem: the top Islamic cleric has weighed in with harsh words for both candidates in the race for Israel's prime minister and urged Muslims who are Israeli citizens not to vote for either one. Prime Minister Ehud Barak faces the right-wing Ariel Sharon at the polls tomorrow in a contest that Sharon is heavily favored to win. Sheikh Ikrema Sabri, who is the Mufti or chief Islamic cleric of Jerusalem, said yesterday, "Why support Barak? What has he done? I would love Sharon to win to reveal to everyone what Zionism is all about." He predicted Arab citizens of Israel would refuse to support Barak, quote, because he killed 13 without any reason, referring to the 13 Israeli Arabs shot by Israeli police during protests in October. Analysts say that without the Arab vote, which makes up about 12% of the electorate, Barak cannot win the election. Meanwhile, Marwan al-Barghouti, a senior official of the mainstream Palestinian organization Fatah, said today that peace talks with Israel would be pointless if Ariel Sharon wins tomorrow's prime ministerial election. He said, "I don't believe that Palestinians have to contact Sharon or to negotiate with him." He went on to say, "The best way to deal with Sharon, the only way to deal with Sharon, is the intifada and resistance." Opinion polls published today forecast that Sharon would crush Prime Minister Ehud Barak in the vote, putting the Likud leader about 20 percentage points ahead.
Brother blood, we are the same spirit, of the same mud. Brother blood, we're from the same water, from the same blood.
Brother blood,
brother blood,
brother blood.
I've got scars from living, scars from love. Strike me dead if I'm lying. I got brothers below and brothers above. With all of our blood we are trying. I keep trying for everything. It comes a piece at a time. I've got a mountain I'm determined to climb. But I took the heat, created the beat. And I've got the heart of a lion.
It's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, standing in the vestibule where Amadou Diallo was shot on February 4th, 1999. It is now 2 years later. There are scores of candles that are lit, blowing in the wind right now on this Sunday evening, where hundreds gathered to remember Amadou Diallo. People now are making a kind of small pilgrimage into the vestibule to look at where Amadou was killed. What are your thoughts today as you visit the site?
Pay my respects.
Like to say something about your thoughts today?
I'd like to pay my respects as well.
Children today really suffer tomorrow. Oh, what a shame.
What a shame.
Such a bad way to live. Who is to blame when we can stop living? Oh.
Close to 1,000 people gathered last night for a candlelight vigil outside the apartment in the Bronx where the unarmed West African immigrant Amadou Diallo was gunned down by 4 white police officers 2 years ago yesterday. Speakers included Amadou Diallo's father, Sekou Amadou Diallo, as well as the Reverend Al Sharpton, who expressed outrage at the Justice Department's ruling last week. The Justice Department said it would not bring civil rights charges against the policemen because the officers did not fire on Diallo, quote, with the specific intent to use unreasonable force. Senior Bush administration officials said it was actually a Janet Reno decision, the former attorney general, who made the decision and signed off on last week's Justice Department ruling before she left office, but delayed the announcement in fear that it would ignite protests at the Bush inauguration. Diallo was a 22-year-old street vendor and student. He was murdered as he stood in the lobby of his apartment building in the early hours of February 4th, 1999. The 4 plainclothes officers who confronted him fired 41 shots. They said they thought he had pulled a gun. It was a wallet. The officers were acquitted of criminal charges in Diallo's death last year in a state trial that was moved to the state capital of New York, Albany, instead of the Bronx, to escape the public anger simmering in New York. We're going to go now to excerpts of the vigil rally that was held yesterday at 1157 Wheeler Avenue, where Amadou Diallo was gunned down. This is the Reverend Al Sharpton.
We want people to understand that what happened to Amadou Diallo in that vestibule is going to take more than a paint job and a new door to erase it from the minds of the people in New York. You can change the scene. but you can't erase the crime. We gonna fight until they pay for the crime of murdering Amadou Diallo 2 years ago. That is what they tried to do in Albany. That's what Southern District tried to do, put a new face. But you can put whatever face you want on it. 41 shots on an unarmed man is murder and a violation of civil and human rights. We come just as angry, just as willing to mobilize and organize as we did 2 years ago. People say, well, what does it mean? It means that unless we're on the case, they will not do right. There's the Amadou Diallo legislation in Albany. We're going to fight and make that pass in Amadou's name. They think we went to one police plaza. We're going to go to the state legislature and force new laws in the name of Amadou Diallo. Just like Jimmie Lee Jackson in Mississippi, murder was used to ignite and mobilize a new country. This murder will change policing because we are still determined. They didn't think that this many people would care 2 years later. But they haven't seen nothing yet. Because when they shot Amadou, they were shooting at anyone going in their home. We have the right to go in our house. We are not guilty until proven innocent. We're not suspects until you figure out why we're doing something. What was he doing in his vestibule 1 o'clock in the morning? He was going home. That's what he was doing. And he had the right to go home. And we want to stand with this family. This has been a very painful day for the Diallos. They came here and have been here at our request for these 2 years. They looked for justice in the courts here in the Bronx. They played criminal justice games, sent the case to Albany, sat there every day watching a weak prosecution and an ultimate insult calling acquittal. And they still waited. And now the federal government comes and says they can't prove without a shadow of a doubt. You can't prove any case without a shadow of a doubt. But there is no shadow of a doubt in our minds that we have the right to go in our own homes.
Lord, we come before you today. We ask you for your blessing. We ask you for you to give strength to this family, for you to keep us united, for you to keep blessing Reverend Shelton, to keep leading this community and leading all of us in what we have to do. We are here, O Lord, today to remember Amadou Diallo. I know, O Lord, that you have taken care of him. But I ask you that to take care of us. I ask you to take care of the family, the pain that this situation has inflicted upon us. I praise you because you are the God of mercy. And today I here to ask you to keep us united, to keep us fighting, to keep us struggling until that day that we could meet you.
We remember Amadou. We will not forget. Amadou was our brother, our neighbor, our son. What happened to Amadou, we will never forget. February the 4th, 1999, in this vestibule, we will never forget. What happened to Venus, the case, the trial from the Bronx to Albany, we will never forget. What happened on the verdict in Albany, we will never forget. What happened recently when the federal government dropped the case, we will never forget. If they dropped the case, we cannot drop it. We will hold it. We'll preserve it in paper and in the computer. We will sit and wait. We are doing all these things to sacrifice for our remaining children, if somebody being shot 41 times, unarmed, and you said you didn't find evidence proof beyond reasonable doubt, I don't know where that will come from. Secondly, after he's been shot here 41 times, they have processed autopsy on his body, find no evidence, no toxic. Went inside the house, ransacked the house, don't find any evidence. We cannot give up. We must go on, even when everything seems to be lost. We have to fight on. We need closure. We need peace. Most of all, we need justice.
But this is a flame of justice.
And that was Sekou Amadou Diallo, the father of Amadou Diallo, along with the Reverend Al Sharpton. As I stood with the mourners last night at 1157 Wheeler Avenue, where Amadou Diallo was gunned down, I spoke with Ruben Diaz, who is the state assembly member who ran last night's vigil.
And I'm the representative of the 75th Assembly District here in the Bronx, which is the area where Amadou was shot and killed.
Your thoughts today?
My thoughts today was that this is the second annual prayer vigil that we have for Diallo. I hosted, you know, we set up, my father and I, Reverend Diaz, we set up the equipment, the sound system, and it's basically a day of remembering what happened to Diallo here and to pray and give our prayers to the family and give and show them our support. I think that today is good because what happens is that people think that because of the media went away and because it's been 2 years that we forgot about what occurred. In fact, you see how the door has been changed, the vestibule has been repainted, but we haven't forgotten. And so even though there's been a number of setbacks in the past year and a half, or the past year rather, we want to make sure that everyone comes together, and then from this day forward, that we push for permanent reform to address what happened at Diallo, as well as other victims.
The U.S. Attorney's Office raised the issue of intent, said the intent of the police officers could not be proven, malicious intent.
I mean, that's almost laughable. I mean, no pun intended. I mean, it's not a laughing matter, but to say that 41 shots, when do you prove intent? After the 30th shot? I mean, you heard everyone count to 41 here. When can you prove it? After the 35th, 36th, 40th shot? Of course they intended to come in here. I believe that Amadou Diallo's rights and constitutional rights were violated as soon as they stopped him. We all know what happened here that night. He was stopped clearly because of the color of his skin. That was racial profiling. And as soon as you stopped Amadou Diallo, in my opinion, you've already violated civil rights. Then to shoot at him 41 times and say that there was no intent, I mean, that's absurd.
Can you talk about the bills that you have in Albany that you've put forward and put it in a national context? There are people listening all over the country right now.
Well, basically, the bills call for a residence requirement. We want all of the police officers on the New York Police Department to live in the city of New York. We want to do away with the 48-hour rule, which is an agreement by the police department and when a bargain agreement when they sign their contracts where they give the police officers a cushion of 48 hours once they've been brought up on charges. We feel that
meaning that they don't have to speak to anyone for 48 hours.
That's correct, that they don't have to speak to anyone. Well, we feel that sends the wrong message. I mean, we as citizens don't have that right or that privilege.
This is after a shooting.
After a shooting or any other incident. We want a civilian complaint review board that's independent of the New York Police Department that is has its, you know, subpoena power, that has teeth to it. We're calling for other, if a police officer, for example, uses more than one language, this is part of the cultural sensitivity package, if they use more than one language to patrol an area and they're using that to communicate with the residents of that area, we feel they should be compensated for it, as well as many other bills. So this is something that has passed in the New York State Assembly for the last two sessions. The Senate hasn't taken up this package of bills. And the governor doesn't even want to talk about it. So we want to make sure that everyone, we start putting the pressure. And like in other situations, such as, for example, we have Megan's Law, we have Jenna's Law. We want to make sure that one day we can come back to the community and say we have Diallo Law.
Your reaction to the reaction to Alan Hevesy saying there are some good police officers?
I actually agree with Alan Hevesy, believe it or not. My sister's a New York police sergeant. And my brother-in-law her husband is a retired police sergeant. So I believe with Alan Hevesy. You know, there's some people, however, who feel like Allen Hevesy, I think that wasn't more about his comment. It was more about whether or not he was involved in this to begin with. I think that he addressed that issue in the National Action Network when there was a forum, and he said that at first he didn't get it, but now he does. And I think that all of our opinions are subjected to revision. And I think that Allen Hevesy is getting it. I think that, however, some people feel like it's a little too late.
What are your concerns about the new Justice Department under Bush, under Ashcroft as Attorney General?
Understand that it's not about Democrat or Republican force. It's about justice. Mary Jo White was there from Bill Clinton. Now, Ashcroft is coming in. I mean, we all have our opinions of Ashcroft, but the reality is that time will tell. Now, we're angry at Mary Jo White. She wasn't put there by President George Bush. So she was put there by President Bill Clinton. Now, I'm a Democrat, and I supported Bill Clinton. It doesn't matter about party politics here. What matters is what's right is right. And I think that her decision was clearly wrong, is a mistake, and I hope that she can look into it and hopefully reconsider the fact that I believe this is a big mistake. It sends the wrong message that now police officers can go out there and racially profile individuals in our communities and shoot at individuals 41 times and have no investigation or no oversight by the Justice Department.
Ruben Diaz, a New York State Assembly member who officiated at last night's vigil on the second anniversary of the killing of Amadou Diallo. He died in a hail of 41 police bullets on February 4th, 1999. When we come back, we'll go back 38 years and we'll hear James Baldwin talk about the killing of four little girls at a Birmingham church. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. African American History Month continues as last night 1,000 people gathered outside the Bronx home of Amadou Diallo. Four policemen let loose the hail of 41 bullets that killed the West African immigrant as he reached for his wallet to identify himself. The crowd was marking the second anniversary of Diallo's death and expressing outrage at a U.S. Justice Department order to drop prosecution of the white police officers. 38 years ago, on September 15th, 1963, another act of violence shook the country. At the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, a dynamite bomb exploded and killed 11-year-old Denise McNair and three 14-year-olds, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Addie Mae Collins. By the end of the day, riots and fires had broken out throughout Birmingham, and another two teenagers were dead. This bombing occurred 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of slavery, but Birmingham, a modern industrial powerhouse of coal and steel, was still a stronghold of racism and Jim Crow segregation. All across the South, though, and increasingly in the North, people were organizing to defy and change the system. James Baldwin was among them. The noted author was articulate and fiery in his outrage. On September 25th, 1963, 10 days after the four little girls died in the church bombing, Baldwin spoke out.
Now, speaking for myself and trying as best I can to discharge what I take to be my responsibility to everyone in the streets, including me, I don't want to see any more blood. Nobody's blood. My God. No, we could end the nightmare tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I could die, you know, in peace. But in fact, the nightmare will not be ended tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And the nation which has admired these boys and girls and men and women overlooks the fact that a boy who was, let us say, 17 in 1955 has now spent 8 years in the streets, is probably under a doctor's care for being beaten half to death by the power structure, ladies and gentlemen, not simply by some idle policeman. Policemen know who they're working for. And by this time, the boy and his wife and his children are very nearly at the end of their rope and are about to crack. This is why it is so important now to try to be precise about what it is that we must do. It is impossible. All my liberal friends and critics to the contrary, it is absolutely impossible for any Negro in this country to be fitted into the structure as it now exists. That is not a possibility. One must be willing to take upon oneself the responsibility of examining and changing the structure so that it becomes more human for everybody. What the Negro's friends pretend, and I'm sorry, baby, but with friends like that, you don't need no enemies, you know. What the Negro's friends pretend is that all the Negro wants is just another Cadillac. He wants to get to be just like Eisenhower. Well, I, speaking for myself, would rather cut my throat than suppose that my forefathers bled and suffered and died for this in this country in order to become yet another blank mediocrity. What we can do, and again, if you remember what I tried to say about economics, and I talked about the landing of the track and what would have happened if we hadn't lined the track. If you think about the myths that American white people have created about American black people, you begin to have some notion of the weight black people have in white people's consciences. It was never true, for example, that I came here wanting to rape nobody, you know. And in fact, I very rarely carried a knife. And I know how to hold my liquor. But the myths to which one is subjected are the most terrifying symptom of the emotional and spiritual and sexual poverty and panic of the American people. If one is aware of this, then one recognizes, I think this is a valuable suggestion, that it is not the Negro who is in jail. It is white people who are in jail. When white people can produce, when this white republic can produce, in the streets of Birmingham, for example, children who can do with those what those black children did, then we may be beginning to approach equality. I think the other reason, and perhaps the most important reason, that I'm throwing the suggestions out to you tonight, is that in this country, every black man born in this country until this present moment is born into a country which assures him in as many ways as it can find that he is not worth the dirt he walks on. Every Negro boy and every Negro girl born in this country until this present moment undergoes the agony of trying to find in the body politic, in the body social, outside himself, herself, some image of himself or herself which is not demeaning. And if you doubt me, you check out your textbooks and Hollywood, to name only those two things. Now, many, indeed, have survived, and at an incalculable cost. And many more have perished, and are perishing every day. If you tell a child, and do your best to prove to the child that he is not worth life, it is entirely possible that sooner or later the child begins to believe it and acts on it. It is one of the reasons, if I may be rude, that in every ghetto in this country, Saturday night is a dangerous night among Negroes. They let it out with each other because they are too intimidated by what we still refer to as man. And what I am trying to suggest is that we have the power to force the country to change its image of us, and we can do this by proving to ourselves and to the country what we can do for ourselves. We don't need yet to become the president of General Motors. We simply need to call the country on the common disaster, and they cannot put 20 million people in jail. Something happens to a person, as I know we all know, when he has achieved his first breakthrough. All I know about my own life, for example, is that I've been scared to death for 39 years and 6 months. And all I know about fear is that if you're afraid of it, walk toward it. No Negro in this country, and no citizen of this country who aspires to create this country, has any reason whatever to be afraid of, let us say, for example, Senator Eastland. We must make, can I say, the establishment afraid of us. And it is perfectly true, you know, I'm speaking only for Jimmy Baldwin again, that everybody in the country, in Washington, was terrified of the very idea of a march on Washington, and can scarcely be said to have embraced it until they realized they couldn't call it off. Now, if we begin to assess our real weight, our real potential, in the light of our common danger, we can get through this. We can win. We can turn the country into something which makes it a little less difficult to become a man. It is very hard to be black and grow up in this country. Manhood, as a friend of mine said, is a very dangerous pursuit for a black man. But I beg you to observe that it has also become a very dangerous pursuit for a white man. That is one of the reasons for Birmingham. It is not possible that all those people in that city really believed or really believe that they have the right to slaughter children. They don't believe that. They're afraid to speak. One of the reasons they are afraid to speak is that the standards by which we live, black and white, north and south in this country, are unlivable standards. It is not important to be safe. It is not important to get a car. It is not important to make it. It is important to become a man. And this is what we have forgotten. And that is one of the reasons that the caliber of our political representatives has become one of the mockeries of the 20th century. There is, my friends, really, a point at which one has to say, I will not choose between the lesser of two evils. There is no such thing as a lesser of two evils. If the political machines in Washington and elsewhere in the nation cannot throw up better material than Mr. Goldwater, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Kennedy, and so on down an extremely dreary line, then perhaps we, the people whom these dreary people are supposed to represent, ought to find a way of being represented. We are not, are we, at the mercy of our political institutions? If we created them, we are responsible for them. We have the right and the duty to overhaul them, to change them. We are not always so helpless that Senator Easton has to stay there forever. Who said so? Isn't it a scandal that in a civilized nation, the death of six children should be met by the cynical, I repeat, cynical appointment of a football player, an ex-general? I dare them to go in any Birmingham barber shop and talk to anybody. I dare them. And I think that commission, the appointment of that commission, the very notion, and the apathy with which the country has greeted it, proves my point. We have no right to allow the death of six children and our common disaster and our common crisis and our moral crisis to be met in this way. It proves, if anything does, that the terms of negotiation must now be radically changed. One cannot negotiate with the representatives of one's oppressor. One must force the administration to recognize that as long as Easton holds his office, is a Democrat, no one who wants a free country can vote the Democratic ticket. And as long as Goldwater holds his place, no one who wants a free country can vote the Republican ticket. It is time to let the nation know that the death of my child, I as a black man, and the spiritual death of your child, you as a white man, cannot be met by sending down a commission to find out what happened. We know what happened. What we have to do is prevent it from happening again. And in order to do that, one doesn't beg the Birmingham City Fathers for a truce. You use whatever weight you have to force them to recognize your presence in that city, in that state, and in this country as a man. No matter what it cost who. I want to say two more things, and then I will leave you. One of them is, it's very important to recognize that the economy of which we are so proud has very shaky foundations. It is very important to recognize that in any case, the economy as it now exists cannot, does not, and cannot supply full employment, that there are more white people out of work numerically than Negroes, and that the future does not look bright. And in my view, though I'm willing to be corrected, I think it is better to spotlight this condition now than wait and have it collapse and precipitate chaos. We can guide the avalanche, or we can try. We haven't got to surrender to it. And the last thing I want to say to you, to suggest to you, is that we in this country, black and white, do have in our hands at this moment an enormous and expensive opportunity. If you can think through our situation, if we can face it, we can do something which has not been done in the history of the world before. The terms of our revolution, the American Revolution, the terms of these, not that I drive you out or that you drive me out, but that we come together and embrace and learn to live together. That is the only way that we can have achieved the American Revolution. Now, if we can face this, and it involves facing a great many things, it demands that white people face the fact that I, for example, or any black person they will ever meet or have ever met, I'm not an exotic rarity, I'm not a stranger, I'm none of those things. On the contrary, for all you know, I might be your uncle, your brother, your cousin. Among other things, one of the things that has happened here, and the pathology of the Deep South proves it, so does the pathology of the North, which dictates to them that they move out when I move in. Among other things which have to be excavated here is the fact that this long history is also the history of a love affair. One has got to face this. I'm no longer really black. Maybe I would like to be. Maybe I'd like to go back to Sierra Leone, for example. That was where I came from. But I've been here a long, 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 long time. And I'm now a part of you. And you are a part of me. And the conditions of our maturity, which is our survival, is that we accept this fact and rejoice in it. If we could do that, we might open up and by the example of our own lives and bodies, a possibility that in the future, mankind all over the world will not find it necessary to blow each other up in order to settle a quarrel. Thank you.
You've been listening to James Baldwin giving a speech after the bombing of the Birmingham church in 1963 that killed four little girls. This on the second anniversary of the police killing of Amadou Diallo in New York. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Amnesty International is about to launch a lawsuit against the CIA to force it to release information about the growing U.S. role in Colombia. The United States is currently implementing Plan Colombia, a $1.3 billion aid package passed without human rights conditions under President Clinton. The funding is supposed to go to counter-narcotics efforts, but as the 36-year-old long civil war continues, much of the U.S. equipment and training directly targets the FARC rebels. As the war and the peace talks both intensify, the U.S. is also supplying human resources. At least 80 U.S. Special Forces troops are training a Colombian Army battalion at the La Randia Army Base in southern Colombia. The U.S. insists that troops have no combat role. The Colombian Army is also supported by an 8,000-member private paramilitary army recently implicated in a massacre in Chengue. Scott Wilson wrote last week in the Washington Post, "In the cool hours before sunrise on January 17th, 50 members of the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia marched into this village of avocado farmers. For an hour, the paramilitary troops pulled men from their homes, starting with 37-year-old Jaime Marino and his three field workers. They assembled them into two groups above the main square and across from the rudimentary health center. Then, one by one, they killed the men by crushing their heads with heavy stones and a sledgehammer. When it was over, 24 men lay dead in pools of blood. Two more were found later in shallow graves. As the troops left, they set fire to the village." The armed forces deny using the paramilitaries as a shadow army against leftist guerrillas, but human rights groups and surviving villagers believe the Colombian military helped carry out the massacre. If they're right, the money trail leads right back to Washington. Amnesty hopes that its lawsuit will establish the facts. We're joined right now by Carlos Salinas. He's Acting Director of Government Relations for Amnesty International USA. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carlos.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us about the lawsuit?
Well, the lawsuit stems from actually 1993. And the reason we're actually going to go to court is that United States government agencies are unlawfully withholding information about a criminal organization that now it turns out they are alleged to have worked with. So what we want to do is make sure that the United States government comes clean about the death squad, because given the current escalation in military aid, it's really important to establish what is the relationship between the United States government and this Colombian death squad.
What information do you have so far?
Well, we've got a long paper trail that we've gotten from several U.S. agencies, from the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Department of Defense, several other agencies detailing this wave of killings that this death squad undertook in 1993. And some estimates go from 80 people killed to several hundred. And the reason that this is so important, this 1993 incident, in addition to the fact that there were criminal activities that were never punished, is that this death squad was the precursor to the National Paramilitary Alliance that is today responsible for most of the killings in Colombia. Just like the one that you've just mentioned in Chengue, the Carlos Castaño, the head of that death squad, the head of the paramilitaries, was a key member of this death squad.
We're also joined on the phone by Sanho Tri, policy analyst at the Institute for Policy Studies. Sanho, the ostensible purpose of U.S. aid is counter-narcotics, but clearly, and as Carlos is laying out, that doesn't sound like it is. I mean, even the real purpose, let alone what's the actual effect of the policy in Colombia.
Well, even one of the key Bush advisors in Latin America, Robert Zoellick, has said we should drop this pretense of making a distinction between counter-narcotics and counter-insurgency, that we need to help the Colombian government with their civil war. And in fact, Congressman Ben Gilman, when he pulled out of his support for this Plan Colombia, also said we should separately debate whether or not to get involved in the Colombian civil war. And this actual counter-narcotics package has very little to address the rest of the drug cultivation in Colombia that's under the control of the paramilitaries.
Amy, if I may.
Carlos Salinas of Amnesty.
What's interesting is that the United States government is giving close to $1.3 billion in assistance to Colombia, most of it to the Colombian army. Yet the army is allied with the paramilitaries who, by the Drug Enforcement Administration's own account, are drug traffickers. So this aid to fight drugs is going to an army whose principal ally in this war in Colombia are drug traffickers. And this is not a new phenomenon. Some of the information that we've gotten from the Defense Intelligence Agency shows that in 1993, they already knew that the people working in this death squad that became the precursor to the National Paramilitary Alliance was involved in drug activity. And not only that, but was also involved in paramilitary atrocities. So it's very interesting that this package to fight drugs is actually going to an army allied with drug traffickers.
Amy, Carlos brings up an important point. Carlos Castaño, the head of the paramilitaries, you know, Mr. Death Squad, has gone on Colombian national television and admitted that he gets 70% of his revenues from the drug economy. This is by his own admission. He's giving press and radio and TV interviews all the time. And yet the DEA doesn't seem interested in finding him. The Colombian government, with all its arrest warrants, can't seem to find him. But any journalist can find this guy. And I was at the embassy, U.S. Embassy in Bogota recently, and I asked them, have you tried calling his press agent?
We're talking to Sano Tree, the policy analyst at Institute for Policy Studies. His focus is Colombia. And Carlos Salinas, who is the acting director of government relations for Amnesty International USA, which is suing the Central Intelligence Agency. When is this lawsuit being launched?
We're thinking that probably in the next few weeks the lawsuit will be formally filed. We're trying to make sure we're ready to go. The CIA, initially, when we first requested the information, wrote back to us saying that they could neither confirm nor deny the existence or non-existence of records. And the second time that we put in the request, there was no reply whatsoever, which is a clear contravention of the law under the Freedom of Information Act.
What do you expect the documents to say?
Well, we expect the documents to fill out the picture of what exactly took place back in 93 and what the United States government knew about this death squad. The key about this death squad is that it's a little window into the paramilitary world as it intersected a key moment in the relationship between the United States and the Colombian government. And so what we hope to get out of these documents is a clearer picture of what that relationship may have looked like.
Do you expect the Bush administration to be any different in continuing the Clinton policy towards Colombia? Sanho Tree and then Carlos Salinas.
Well, there have been some interesting trial balloons, or mixed messages at least. You've had people like Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, saying that the drug war is going to be won by our families, by our churches, our schools, our doctors, not by the military. He understands very clearly this is a demand-driven problem, not a supply problem. And you've got Colin Powell also seems to be a little backpedaling a little bit in his support for the current policy, saying he doesn't want to support anything that's going to spread the conflict further in the region, which this entire aid package will. So it's a good sign that things haven't been set in stone in this new administration yet, and people should call in and let them know how they feel about it.
And I think that, this is Carlos, I think that's really important, yet we have to keep in mind sort of what's the history of a lot of members of the current Bush administration and the former Bush administration. And I would remind the listeners that it was the George W. Bush's father, President Bush, who declared the drug problem a national security threat in 1989 and really launched the war on drugs. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the policy evolves. Also, I will remind people that General McCaffrey, the former head of the Office of National Drug Control Policy under President Clinton, when he came on board as the drug czar, made some of the very same comments and said that in fact that the war metaphor was not appropriate, that we couldn't jail our way out of the problem, and yet look at what he's done. He was one of the principal architects of this $1.3 billion aid catastrophe that was passed by President Clinton in July for really increasing the blood flow in Colombia.
As the money flow has increased into Colombia from the United States, the so-called aid package, the U.S. is spearheading the fumigation program, ostensibly aimed at killing Colombia's lucrative coca crop. But the herbicide has also been implicated in killing food crops and causing major health problems. San Hotri of the Institute for Policy Studies, can you talk about that? And also, isn't it Monsanto that makes the Roundup pesticide?
Right. It's a form of Roundup they're using down there. The exact formulation they haven't released to us yet. But we are spraying this very broad-spectrum herbicide that kills anything green, and we're dumping it over vast stretches of the Amazon basin. This past month alone, they fumigated or sprayed more than 62,000 acres of rainforest. They claim they're only hitting these coca fields, but in fact they're hitting all kinds of fish ponds and pastures and regular farms. And so it's going to cause a lot of hunger in the next few months. But historically, the best we've ever been able to do is push drug cultivation from one country or one region to the next. The reason we have this problem in Colombia is because we squeezed hard on Bolivia and Peru, while demand in the United States and other rich countries has remained constant. So someone will always meet that demand. And all we're going to do with this program, I think, is push coca cultivation further into the Amazon, and we'll keep spraying and defoliating greater and greater stretches of this most delicate ecosystem.
And Amy, as this defoliation campaign increases,
Carlos Salinas,
and as the U.S.-trained battalions get ready to move in or actually begin carrying out their first operations, we're seeing a sharp escalation in paramilitary attacks. So far this year, there have been more than 20 massacres in Colombia. And that's a staggering number. And more than 200 people killed just so far this year alone.
Well, we have to wrap up the segment. I want to thank you both for being with us. San Hotri of Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. The website is ips-dc.org. And thank you to Carlos Salinas, Acting Director of Government Relations, Amnesty International. And that website is www.amnestyusa.org/countries/Colombia. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!